Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hey, everybody. You got Mark here from the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Today, I had the privilege and pleasure of interviewing Mr. Mike Caro, the legendary mad genius of poker. If you play poker, you probably know him from his fantastic book, Caro's Book of Poker Tells, which I've read a few times now, and it is brilliant. Truly, truly brilliant. And the crazy thing is that Mike was instrumental in really being a pioneer on the vast majority of the poker research and strategies that you've read today. Doyle Brunson has called him one of the greatest players and strategists of all time. And if you know anything about poker and negotiation, you'll know that they're very similar in a lot of ways. The advice that I give to a lot of people is, listen, if you want to get good at negotiation, start playing poker. Because it really is fascinating how staggeringly close the two are together. He is often considered as the world's foremost authority on poker strategy, psychology, and statistics. He teaches the correlations between poker and life. And, you know, upwards of a decade ago, when he was at the top of his game, disappeared. He just left the spotlight. And so in this interview, we get a very, very rare glimpse into what Mike Caro is doing now and some of the work that he's putting together that's going to be ready in about 2.5 years for us all to consume. So I'm super excited about sharing this interview with you. I'm a huge Mike Caro fan, and having him on the show was a real, real treat. I think you're really going to love it. Thank you so much for joining. Enjoy. Mr. Mike Caro, how are you?
I'm great, Mark. How are you? It's an honor to be on your podcast.
Well, thank you so much for being on, man. It's such a privilege and an honor to speak with you. You know, having read your book a few times and seen you on TV so many times talking about poker and having so many people speak about you as not only the mad genius of poker, but also one of the people that are the most instrumental in the psychology and the strategy of poker and the correlation between poker and life. Having you on is a great privilege. So thank you so much for being on.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me.
Mike, you pioneered some of the most important strategy ever written. And I mean, being a fan of your work, I'm a bit confused because you were seemingly at the top of your game over a decade ago, and then you disappeared and you went into hiding. What happened? Where'd you go? Why?
Well, I just decided I wanted to be a hermit in the Ozarks. So it's just a simple thing. Most of my work at the time, even though I was in the public spotlight, it was crazy then. Poker was at its very, very peak. And you couldn't even move down a hall in Las Vegas without having to be stopped by people every few feet. It was a crazy time for poker. And it wasn't just me. It was everybody else who was in the poker spotlight. And I was working mostly behind the scenes as a consultant and on projects. And I decided I just wanted to get away. I was getting older, and I always wanted to be on a lake fishing in a woods. So I started looking for property, and I found one and bought it sight unseen. And I found myself, instead of at, you know, what was like an eighth of an acre in Los Angeles, and people telling you it might have been a quarter of an acre, I might be exaggerating in the down sense, But in Los Angeles, with people telling you, wow, where did you find this property? How did you get all this extra lawn space? I found myself on 41 acres lakefront and 6 miles of trails I put in for golf carts and four-wheelers. And then I was communing with the furry animals and just gradually tried to lose contact with the world. But then I got discovered out here and had to be called out for a few seminars, one in Ireland. And that was the worst of it. But gradually I've just completely faded. You're talking to a man who used to be Mike Carroll.
Well, you still have all of the personal characteristics of and the brilliance that's associated with the former Mike Caro. So, you know, having you on is such a treat, because I think one of the things that you do very well is that some of the things that you've spoken about between the correlation of poker and life, I think is really unique. And being a very amateur player, I often, whenever I play, I often think that poker is very much like life and very much like negotiation. You've often said that, you know, the game of poker and the game of life, the correlation is staggering. What do you mean by this?
Well, poker is like life in a lot of senses. The strategy is similar. However, there are certain poker-like situations that are not like life, but there are so many overlaps that it's meaningful.
Yeah.
For instance, if it's not a winner-take-all situation, you're not in a poker-like situation. So negotiation is not necessarily like poker. It is to some degree, but mostly you're not trying to find a solution where you beat an opponent. You're trying to find a solution that you're happy with and that the person you're dealing with or persons will also be happy with the outcome. So yeah. That's I wouldn't consider negotiation strictly poker-like, but there are a lot of similarities between poker and the way you treat people in life as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I would think that I think one of the things that I can liken most to poker and negotiation is that you're always dealing with unknowns. There's so many unknown situations, and I think learning how to deal with those unknowns is a very big part of poker, obviously, and also negotiation, getting comfortable with that gray area and learning how to think. Learning how to have probabilistic thinking.
That's because you never know what to expect in poker or in life. And in negotiations, you really don't know what to expect. You can predict with some probability, but things can go quickly off course or in another direction. And that brings me to Carroll's Law of Loose Wiring. This is probably one of my proudest concepts. Carroll's Law of Loose Wiring, let me see, I can read it to you. It says, if choices are not clearly connected to their benefits, people usually interact in ways that make outcomes unpredictable.
Yes.
In other words, if you're negotiating, if it's clear to the person you're speaking with or negotiating with that there is a benefit, then you can pretty much predict what direction that conversation will go. However, if the benefit is unclear and people are unsure of how they should react or what their decision would be, their decision is not clear, then anything can happen. That's why history itself is so interwound and unpredictable, because small events that were based on no real decision, kind of made at whim, can change the history of the world and do continually. And this happens in your everyday life, whether you're negotiating, whether you're dealing in a romance, whether you're dealing in business. Things happen on the spur of the moment because most people are making decisions that they're not sure about. They're not sure which way to go. And that's not all their decisions, but that's a vast majority of their decisions. And when they have to do that at whim, that decision leads to another decision and another decision, and somebody else who might be unsure goes a different direction, and the predictability of the outcome is unknown. So again, if choices are not clearly connected to their benefits, people usually interact in ways that make outcomes unpredictable. That's true in poker, that's true in life, it's true in negotiations, and it's something to consider. That's why outcomes are so puzzling to people.
Why do you think we do that? Like, is it because we make those decisions because we're lazy? We don't do enough work to determine whether or not those decisions are the right decision? Like, why do we just make decisions at whim?
Well, some decisions should be made at whim. However, it's essential when a conclusion can be logically come to that you do all your homework, that you're prepared. But some things don't matter. Some things really don't matter. People don't perceive that one way is better than the other, so they can go either direction. Now, there are a lot of borderline decisions that you make, Mark, every day in your life that really don't matter, and you're not going to spend the effort to decide whether or not you should get this brand of milk or the other brand of milk, because it's not worth your time going into the details and evaluating that in great importance. It's not greatly important to you whether or not you get the right brand. It just doesn't matter. So obviously you have to focus on things that are important. And therefore, since so many things that you encounter every day are not important, then you are going to make those pretty much at whim. And so do the people that you deal with, and it's important to understand that.
Do you think that we sometimes put ourselves into a position of believing that some decisions aren't important when they actually are, and we should have put in the research when we didn't?
I think that's true. I think we would agree, both of us, in saying that that is absolutely the fact, that in fact most people don't put the effort into making decisions, not because they don't perceive them as important, but because it's too taxing on the brain. People don't want to do work. People don't want to go to the effort to gain that advantage.
Yeah, I find there's a lot. We had Annie Duke on the show, and she spoke about decision quality and the biases that we have when it comes to decisions. And one of the things that she spoke about specifically, which really echoes what you said, is people are lazy. People don't do the work required to make the right decisions. And even if we make the right decisions, there's something that we have to get comfortable with is there's still a certain amount of things that are out of our hands when we make those decisions. There's a certain amount of luck, quote unquote, that goes with something. So even if it was a good decision, the outcome may still be bad. And one of the things she mentioned was getting in the habit of trying to make good decisions, even if the outcome might be bad.
Well, that's correct. Annie is correct on that and so many other things. So I'm a believer in that. And what you need to know is that your decisions are not based on what's going to work. Great decisions are based on what's most likely to work.
Yes.
So what are the probabilities? Yes. What is the cost of that decision? So what is the overall profitability of that decision that you're making? And you have to weigh these things, and you're not going to be able to do it mathematically all the time. I mean, I do it mathematically, but because I have a lot of time on my hands to analyze things. But when you have to do this at the spur of the moment, you're not likely to be able to analyze it with perfection, but you are able, as you go on in life, you're able to get a better and better understanding of what probabilities work. I have my most well-known quote is, in the beginning, everything was even money. Now, that sounds kind of like a trivial set of words there, but it actually has meaning. In the beginning, everything was even money, because when you were born, you had no consciousness of probability to speak of. I could have told you that it's trains that fly and airplanes or little scooters that go on the ground, and it would be 50-50 to you. It's even money, because you don't know. You don't have any information to make a decision on.
That's right.
As you mature, you learn that the probabilities of surviving crossing this busy freeway are maybe 999 out of 1,000. And then your sense of it is that, well, 999 out of 1,000 isn't very good, because 1 out of 1,000 times I'm going to die. And if I do this enough times, I'm going to be dead. And so you develop, without even doing calculations, you develop a good sense of probability. The most successful people in life all have a good sense of probability. That's an essential tool.
One of the things that I love about your work is, yeah, in a way, you're teaching people how to increase the likelihood of something happening through using tells and understanding the psychology behind what's going on in a game. And I think I liken that a lot to negotiation in a way, because we could know what the probability of something happening is, but we can also influence the probability of something happening through persuasive techniques in negotiation, thereby sort of stacking the deck in our favor.
Well, you're absolutely right, Mark. And the essence of negotiation, you know, I've never seen, most of my work has been behind the scenes, not as the public persona. You know, I go into that mad genius mode where I'm on stage and I'm kind of a wild character, but that's all put on. But I love doing it. I do that at seminars and at the poker table. But beyond that, I've sat in and actually guided many negotiations, and I've never yet seen, maybe you have, any of the typical negotiations that you may see in the movies, where somebody is hard as nails and just trying to pin the opponent to the wall. These aren't opponents, first of all. If you think of them as opponents, you might be on the wrong track. All negotiations I've ever seen have moments of civility and small talk and laughter, even giggling sometimes and teasing, intermixed with the hard chore of negotiating. Have you ever seen a negotiation where somebody was like these really ruthless people in appearance that you sometimes see in the movies?
Never. Yeah, never. I think the media has done us a disservice in that way, because, I mean, we see movies like Wolf of Wall Street or Boiler Room or things like that, where you've got these slick-talking, you know, Wall Street types that get to deals. And I mean, the fact is, it's not like that at all. I think it's more civil conversation than anything.
Right. And you're not going to take any joy in destroying an opponent. That's not what it's about. That's not what negotiation is about. It's about coming to a deal that's hopefully very favorable to you, but especially if you're making a relationship that you may be dealing with this person or this entity again in the future, you might even take not quite as good a deal as you might be able to negotiate the first time around, just in order. It's like a loss leader, they call it in marketing, or in, if you have a store, you have a product up there that you're really not going to make a profit on, but it's going to cement other deals that people make when they come in the door. That's not typical in a lot of negotiations that I've been involved with. But sometimes it's a long-term relationship and you want to go down that path. So you may be able to take something off or be a little bit liberal on your first deal.
Yeah, totally agree with you. And I think one of the major mistakes a lot of people make when they get into negotiations is they misinterpret a lot of the messages that they're getting from the other party, specifically when it comes to body language or the inflection of their voice. And in fact, when I was reading through your book for the second time, your section on nervousness really, I mean, that for me really speaks volumes when it comes to negotiation. You mentioned that a lot of people misinterpret nervousness and it can be very, very costly. And the same is true in a negotiation. What do you mean by misinterpreting nervousness and how can we correctly interpret that?
Well, this goes back to poker, Mark. In poker, people who suddenly show shaking hands, for instance, and they were previously steady. Now, there are some people who just shake naturally because they have a medical problem or because that's just their demeanor. But let's say they're previously steady and they suddenly break out with this shaking, this trembling. That's always a sign that they've made a big hand. They've actually connected. It's a release of energy. It's actually, the tension is suddenly gone. And that's what happens. People misinterpret this very frequently because they think that, and they've been told in old poker books, which are completely incorrect, that's a sign that somebody's bluffing. When people are bluffing, or as somebody you're discussing a negotiation with is trying to look strong, they don't look nervous because they've made themselves, they forced themselves to look the opposite. And so when people are forcing themselves to look strong, they're usually weak. So if you notice that based on the general level of the conversation up until that point, that person is now suddenly more assertive, that's weakness. If they're more casual and seem less caring, that's strength.
Yeah. I find the same is true in negotiation. Generally, if people look nervous when they've made an offer for something or they've made a request for something, usually that means that if they connect, if they get what they want, that's going to be a big windfall for them. And so a lot of people misinterpret that as, okay, this is something that I should take because they're nervous about it, when in fact that is probably the area where you need to be most careful because they might be trapping you.
They could be. If they're playing poker, so to speak, then they could be trapping you. It could be an act. However, poker is a different environment. In poker, you're forced to be in this alien environment where you must conceal the strength of your hand. The strength of your hand in poker is always your secret.
Yes.
And therefore, the natural inclination is to always act opposite of the true strength of your hand. Act weak when you're strong. This is what people do. And they act strong when they're weak. So if I hear somebody sigh, then I know that that's a tell that they're actually very strong. Why else would, if they were really weak, why would they bother to convey that to me? Why would they go out of their way to convey that their hand is weak? So that always means strength. In a negotiation, as you're talking about, or any normal human exchange, that's not quite as clear because they could be just naturally letting you know how they feel, mm-hmm. or they could be acting. So we really don't know in those situations for certain.
Calling all multitasking negotiators, I am speaking to you, so listen up. Whether you're listening on your commute or the Peloton or anywhere in between, this is important. Are you looking for ways to increase your procurement productivity and save thousands of dollars? Scout RFP helps to simplify and automate the sourcing process so you can get more done faster. You need to check out Scout RFP at scoutrfp.com/negotiation. I'm going to repeat that. That's scoutrfp.com/negotiation. Stop digging through spreadsheets, emails, and documents for contracts and project information. You are wasting your time and your valuable resources. You need a better tool, and that's Scout. Over 190 global brands like Adobe, Biogen, EasyJet, Salesforce, and Zappos trust Scout RFP's automated sourcing and supplier engagement platform. Scout RFP's platform is super easy to use, and most organizations can get up and running in just hours. You need to see for yourself at scoutrfp.com/negotiation. I know Scout. I've used Scout. I trust these guys. Check it out at scoutrfp.com/negotiation. And now back to your show. And I think that's one thing that you speak very clearly of is it's important to baseline that behavior, right? Because it may be a natural tendency. So you don't really know for sure if it's a tell until you have an understanding of how that person usually responds to certain situations.
Yes, but it's pretty universal in poker. And you're absolutely correct about life situations and interactions. You don't know in life. And you have to baseline it, as you put it. And that's exactly your task, is to decide. One thing that I teach this in both life and in poker, is to always ask yourself what someone else wants. Every time somebody is saying anything at all, or doing anything, it's because they know they're being observed or listen to, and they want something. So your task is to figure out from what they said what they want. And the way I teach this is to be that person. I know this sounds a little bit flaky, but it actually, after practicing it again and again, everybody I've taught this to is able to do that. You be that person. You're like an actor portraying a part. You become that person, and then you relive whatever actions you just perceived in your mind, and how does it feel? How does it feel? After a little practice, this will be magic. How does it feel? I'm this person. I'm now in character. I'm the person that I'm talking to, and I just made this motion. What do I want? What do I want by making this motion? It becomes very clear. Or by saying these words, or using this tone of voice. How does it feel? Does it feel natural or unnatural? That's how you get to the bottom of it.
Interesting. And so we're really just trying to put ourselves in their shoes, trying to understand their situation so that we can get a better read on them.
I realize to most people that sounds like gibberish because they haven't actually tried it. But when you're able to do that, any really superior actor can tell you that that works.
Yeah, that goes back to sort of their method acting and becoming that individual to get the best response possible.
Right.
Brilliant. So a question, just taking a bit of a left turn here. There's a lot of misconceptions about poker by those who don't play. What do you think is the biggest misconception about poker?
Well, the biggest misconception, and it's practiced by some of the named players today, is that they're trying to win the pot. Poker isn't about winning pots, just as negotiations or business is not about making a profit on every deal. It's about whether that deal will work enough times relative to the cost to make it profitable if you were to do it a million times. That's the same in poker. You're not trying to win pots. I once had a reporter ask me, well, what's really the object of poker except obviously to win pots, he said. And I had to inform him that the object of poker is not to win pots. Because if you wanted to just win pots, all you'd have to do is play every hand, bet every time you could bet, and raise every time you could raise, and you'd either win the pot prematurely because somebody wouldn't call you, or you'd win every showdown that that hand could possibly win. You'd be the world champion of winning pots, but you'd lose all your money. And you don't want to do business that way either. Because just like in poker, if you do that in business, you're playing all the chances and you're not picking and choosing. There's nothing wrong. You're not trying to win pots. You're trying to make correct decisions. Same in life.
So you got to be very selective about what you play and what you don't play. And the same is true in life, is what you're saying is you got to be very selective about what you negotiate and what you don't negotiate.
That's correct. Well, of course, I mean, I've listened to you. You're a master of negotiations, and you know that you have things you can throw away. So you're asking for things, I believe. In your last podcast where you were talking to Robert Greene, you said that the fear of asking for too much in negotiations was a big problem.
Yeah,
that
huge.
People in negotiations fear asking for too much and that they'll be rejected. That's the fear of rejection.
That's right.
Robert Greene said that you have to face your fears. Everybody has fears. Decide what they are and then compensate for that by, you know, diving into the pool that you fear the most, taking baby steps, kind of, if I can paraphrase, and going along into your fears, playing into your fears so that that weakness that you've identified in yourself is no longer a problem.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. I think one of the biggest issues I see in negotiation is the same that you've seen in poker, where people are trying to win every pot, and they're trying to play in negotiation, to make a correlation, they're trying to play every hand. So just because you've conceded on one thing in a negotiation doesn't mean that you've conceded on the whole thing. And I think people feel like they've got to win every single section of a negotiation. They've got to win every single part of a negotiation. But the negotiation is made up of a bunch of different terms and conditions and prices and delivery and, you know, whatever it might be, that's all a part of that complex negotiation. And so people think that they have to win everything.
If you ever get stuck, you can just say, you know, this is a really tough negotiation for both of us, because we're both trying to get, you know, something that works for us. Mm-hmm. And can you think of any creative ideas that can make this happen? That's I like to use that a lot. Pass the ball to them, because you may end up getting some points made that will help you that you didn't even expect to get.
That's right.
If you tell them we're in a tough situation, and can you think of any ideas that will magically make this happen, that's a no loss situation. You're passing it to them. People love to hear the word, can they do magic or can they be creative?
Yeah. I often use the wording, to try and drum up ideas or get creative, I use the wording, let's use some hypothetical questions. You know, what if we did this, or what if we did that, to get people in the mindset of using hypothetical questions to generate ideas. And the great thing about hypotheticals is, like, no one's on the hook, right? It's not like you're going to suggest something and then I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to hold you to that. That's not the point. The point is to generate those ideas so that you can come up with something creative that makes sense for both parties.
Yes, that's excellent. That's an excellent technique.
Yeah. One of the things that you said earlier on in this interview is you said when you're weak, you're strong, and when you're strong, it means you're weak. Do you think sometimes the same is true for a negotiation?
Yes, I do, but not consistently so. There are some people who are readable. Again, you have to get inside that person. Everybody has a different personality, Mark.
Yeah.
And so it's everybody is alien to you, and they will remain alien to you until you put yourself into their body, so to speak, just temporarily pretend, not really. And then, well, obviously not really. And then try to think, if you were that person and you were saying these words and they sound aggressive or assertive, are they true? Well, if you've successfully become that person, you know whether those words are true or not. It's magic. I mean, just try this sometimes. The more, and it's, you're going to fail the first few times you try this, but the more adept you get at doing this, putting yourself in somebody else's position, and magically at that point, every movement, every action, every intonation of what they say becomes either obviously phony or real.
Brilliant. One of the things
I think everybody is, Mark, everybody is trying to convince you at every time. They're only saying things. This is the reality of life.
That's right.
Everybody is doing things or saying things because they want something. Maybe they want to be liked. Maybe they want money. Maybe they have some motive that is causing them to say or do what they are, but they know they're on stage. They know they're being observed. And as long as they know they're being observed, everything they do is to their benefit. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother to do it. And once you understand that they're making a move or saying certain words or using a tone of voice, and that's only because that's what they want it to project, then it's much easier, not certain, but much easier to figure out what they want. And we get back to the point that I made a while ago, is that you always try to figure out what a person wants.
Yes. And I want to talk about tilt for a second and how that relates to real life. Because oftentimes in a negotiation, if we get a bad deal, if we walk away from a deal with something that we don't like, oftentimes that puts us in tilt and we get into the next negotiation. For those of us that negotiate sort of at high volumes, and we end up making one bad decision after the next bad decision, and it really hits us emotionally. Can you describe for the listeners what tilt is and how it relates to our lives?
Well, tilt in poker is a term that means you've suffered emotional damage. In other words, you've had big hands beaten, and suddenly you were playing a disciplined game, and now because of that emotion, things are not in focus anymore. And it's like a pinball machine, an old-fashioned pinball machine, that if you shook it too much, the word tilt would come on, the flippers wouldn't work anymore, the lights went out, and your game was over. So that's where the term in poker came from. In life, I have something called Carroll's Threshold of Misery. Carroll's Threshold of Misery states that, doesn't state, it's just a concept. It says that once you get past a certain point of bad luck, bad things happening, you stop caring because the additional sums, the additional added on to that, doesn't matter anymore. Taking poker as an example, let's say you were you're a small limit player or medium limit player, and you say, I don't want to lose any more than 4,000 tonight. And so you somehow creep past that to 4,200, and now suddenly you're down 8,390. I submit that at that point, if you lose another 400, it doesn't matter, but it mattered when you first started. So that's the danger area. You've crossed Carroll's threshold of misery. And this happens in real life. It happens in romance. It happens in business. you stop caring about the normal things because the overwhelming weight of this, the bad luck is just taking control of your existence, and you don't think those decisions matter anymore. But the trick is to keep making good decisions, just zero it out, stop caring. What's gone is gone. You have to care about the new decisions. And each one of those may not seem to matter right now because of the extreme force of the great bad luck that you've received. But eventually, if you make these decisions, they will matter. They'll add up. So you have to keep making good decisions no matter how badly things go.
Yeah, it's almost like a sunk cost fallacy in a way, right? Like where you've already bought something and now you're thinking, well, that was a bad decision. I shouldn't have bought that, but I've got to implement it now because I've already spent the money. So like the same is true for life. I often find there's this consistency of bad decisions because we made a bad decision to begin with based on, or even if it was a good decision, but it turned out bad. Now we've decided that we've got to continue to make that series of decisions when in fact we don't have to, we can stop.
Right. That's brilliant. That's exactly right. In poker, you never have anything invested in the pot. This is a misconception. You have nothing invested in a pot. That money is out there for anybody to win. It doesn't matter whether it was dropped from the sky, or whether you put it all in the pot or somebody else put it all in the pot or it was put in mutually, it makes no difference. The decision is always based on the value of the pot. So in business also, it doesn't matter what you have. Never matters. And in life, it never matters what you have invested in anything. That's always irrelevant. It's not even a factor that you would put into an equation. What you have invested is of no relevance whatsoever. It's what it's worth now. If you were just to sit down in Mark Graffin's position and take over Mark's negotiation right now, one factor that would not matter is what you have invested. It would be just, okay, I just took over. I'm playing this game. Here's what it's worth. Here's what I'll sell it for. And that's your decision. Yeah. Investment in anything never matters. Anything, ever.
Yeah, brilliant. I love it.
We're talking about making a bad purchase.
Yeah.
Well, it's irrelevant now. You've made the purchase. It's done. We're starting at zero here.
Totally agree with you. Mike, people want you to, you know, come out of the Ozarks and continue doing seminars and things like that. I'm sure you're working on something. In fact, the last time we chatted, you mentioned you were working on a massive project. What is that?
Well, it's one of the stupidest things I ever did. Instead of 56 programs, each marketed individually that is based on my latest research into the intricacies of poker, and a gym where you can practice, and exercises, and a poker room where you can play, and a lab where you can analyze everything. I've taken these 56. I decided I had this brilliant idea. I thought it was a brilliant idea. It was a stupid idea, but I still call it brilliant because it was brilliant at the time that I thought of it. I would make this all into one massive computer program. So I've been working on that now for 3 years. I have about 2.5 years to go. And if I don't die first, it might be significant.
Brilliant. So in 2 years from now, we'll see the greatest poker computer program ever written.
Correct. Awesome. This all grew out of my ORAC, which is Carol spelled backwards, which was the first artificially intelligent poker program. That was back in 1983, and my research has been evolving ever since, and I'm obsessed with it. What a waste of a life, right, to be obsessed with the poker. Fortunately, I get to delve into life strategy along the way and do other interesting things, but it's been an obsession that has taken hold of my life. But this will be the last of it. And I will then reemerge into the poker world start doing seminars again and start playing poker again. But I wish I could do that today and not have to wait 2.5 more years, which it's going to take. So thank you for asking and making me feel bad.
I'm sorry that I made you feel bad, but I can tell you that I'm very excited for when it gets released, and I'm really excited for when you come out with it. People, I know for sure, are going to want to follow you online, and you still have an active Twitter account, and you're still doing stuff online. Can we link out to that and make sure that people follow that online for you?
You can follow me on Twitter. That's twitter.mikecarroll.com. But all you'll get is, you really won't get any casual conversation. I won't show pictures of the food I ate. You'll get a link every day to an article at PokerOne.com. But you can just go to PokerOne.com. That's my website. That's my life's work is there. It's free. And it's poker and the numeral one.com. So thank you for letting me make that plug.
Oh, you're so welcome. And I love that resource.
You can also be my friend on Facebook if you'd like.
Right on. Well, Mike, man, it's such a privilege and an honor to have you on. I feel very blessed to have spoken to you today. I'm a huge fan of your work. Having read your book a few times and read a number of your articles, I count myself very lucky to have had a conversation with you. So thank you very much for being on.
Well, you're most gracious, and I enjoyed this very much. Thank you.
Hey, friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.